Welcome to In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. What you're hearing is a flourishing of life at the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge. The refuge is located along the river delta of the Bear, at the point where the river meets the Great Salt Lake. This recording from the Western Soundscape Archive at the University of Utah was made at dawn back in 2010. If you follow the local news, you know that the Great Salt Lake and the life that it supports is in trouble. The lake dropped to its lowest level on record, 4,191.3 feet above sea level, on July 23rd. And it got lower from there. But even before water levels dropped to that point, scientists were warning that the lake faced ecosystem collapse. The culprit was the lack of water, and one thing that the low water levels at the lake did, and continues to do, really, is that it exposed to the air coral-like structures called microbialites. Microbialites are these rigid underwater mounds that house colonies of microbes, microbes that are the basis for essentially all of the life that the lake supports. Here's Michael Vandenberg, senior geologist with the Utah Geological Survey, explaining how all of this works in an earlier episode of this show. He starts by telling us what those microbialites are.
You can think of them as like a building.
Okay.
And the microbes are the occupants of this building, and they're the builders. So they're creating the structure, and they live inside the structure, and they live on top of the structure. And of course, all this takes place underwater. And so when the lake level comes down and these things become exposed, those microbes can't survive. So the beautiful microbial mat, as we call it, that lives on top of these structures, the microbes will start to die, and the microbial mat will begin to erode off the top of the structure. So these microbes are at the base of the food chain, the bottom of the ecological pyramid. And so the brine shrimp and also the brine fly larvae both feed on these microbes. And then in turn, the millions of migrating birds that come and use Great Salt Lake, they come here because of this food source, so it is the brine shrimp and these brine flies. You can imagine once you start eroding the base of the ecological pyramid, you know, there's consequences all the way up that chain.
So the whole ecosystem is threatened. Imagine millions of birds who have been migrating the same route for generation after generation, going back thousands and thousands of years, quite suddenly not having the feeding ground that they used to have. So there's that tragedy unfolding. There's also a big industry on the lake that relies on harvesting brine shrimp. It's worth millions of dollars, and if the microbes go away, as you heard, so do those brine shrimp. So it's a disaster in the making for the lake itself, for the web of life that it supports, for industry. But the effects of the lake drying out don't end there. There's a significant threat to human health and even just a simple livability, not on the lake itself, but in northern Utah in general, if the lake keeps drying up. Actually, it's both a threat and the present-day reality.
Now we have more than 800 square miles of exposed lake bed, and that exposed lake bed is a source of dust to the atmosphere. The 800 miles, just to put it into perspective, is the size of the island of Maui in Hawaii, and it's 3/4 the size of the state of Rhode Island.
That's Dr. Kevin Perry, chair of the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah, last week at an event put together by Utah House Speaker Brad Wilson, the Great Salt Lake Summit. Perry has been studying how areas of the lake that are now dry, how those areas lead to dust storms, and why that's, well, bad.
Arsenic is the element that poses the most concern for human health, and every single measurement of arsenic that I took out on the Great Salt Lake exceeded the EPA regional screening levels. for not only residents, but for industrial workers. And because it's uniformly distributed around the lake, it actually indicates that it's a naturally occurring element. There may be smaller pockets of pollution, but for the most part, it's naturally occurring. And so, if people are exposed to this over a long period of time, then it can lead to significant increases in lung cancer, skin cancer, bladder cancer, and cardiovascular disease and diabetes. But arsenic wasn't the only element of concern as well. Lanthanum, lithium, boron, copper, cobalt, et cetera. So there are heavy elements that we need to be concerned about, and we do need to limit our exposure to those. So what are the potential health impacts of that dust? There are two types of exposures that we need to worry about. One is acute. You see that big dust storm coming in. That has an immediate impact on people's lungs and their ability to breathe. And that is what we call a measure of the PM10 and the PM2.5, which are regulated by the EPA and monitored by the Utah Division of Air Quality. So when you see those, we have immediate health impacts. And then you have the chronic impacts associated with the long-term exposure of dust from the lake itself.
Again, that's Dr. Kevin Perry with the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Utah. And just in case you think that because you don't live that close to the Great Salt Lake, this isn't a big deal to you, think again.
It actually turns out that the dust impacts everybody in northern Utah. And by northern Utah, I mean everybody from Fremonton to Logan to Ogden to Salt Lake to Provo and south. This is something that we will all be impacted by.
The economic impacts of mitigating the problem, another disaster in the making. At one point during the summit, a speaker talked about the potential decline in home value because of the declining livability resulting from those dust storms. Again, the organizer and host of last week's Great Salt Lake Summit was Utah House Speaker Brad Wilson. Wilson is one of the most powerful people in Utah because, to a large extent, he controls the legislative agenda. And hang on to that a minute, because the agenda of the upcoming session will be a part of all of this. But first, back to the problem. The crisis, really, presented by the drying up of the Great Salt Lake. We've talked so far about the ecosystem-level threats, the worry that the foundation of the pyramid is at risk. We've heard about the danger of breathing in what gets blown off of the dried-up lake bed, and about the threat to industry, livability, home values. But wait, there's more.
In February 2021, last year, if anyone remembered this event in February, where basically cars were just covered in red dust of February 2021. That's what we call a snowing dust event. And I'm showing that layer within the snowpack. It's thick, it's dispersed through the whole snowpack. And that means that the dust was entrained within the snow as it was deposited.
That's Dr. Mackenzie Skiles, an assistant professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Utah. And she's describing something that you've likely heard about before. When dust settles on snow, it makes the snow darker, and the snow therefore absorbs a lot more sunlight and melts more quickly.
So snow is actually one of the brightest natural surfaces on Earth. It reflects 90% of incoming sunlight. But when you put something like dust on it and make it darker, that's an impact we can see. It's visually darker. It's absorbing more sunlight. And so the direct impact from that dust is the absorption of more solar radiation, and that rapidly accelerates melt. But then that also sets off a series of feedbacks where it makes the snow age faster, and older snow also absorbs more sunlight. And then it melts snow along the edges of the snowpack, and the underlying ground is darker than the snow, and that absorbs more sunlight, and it melts snow at the edges. This can rapidly accelerate the melting and decrease of the mountain snowpack. So from this one event in 2017, the snowpack melt was accelerated by 1 week. That's one dust event.
One dust event, accelerating snow melt by 1 week. So imagine what a lot more dust storms from a dried up Great Salt Lake might do to the snow in our mountains. It's bad news not just for skiers, but for, well, everybody who relies on the snowpack to provide a steady source of water for municipal, agricultural, and other uses.
The snowmelt from our mountainous headwaters sustains the major rivers and reservoirs, and it can provide, for example, for the city or municipality of Salt Lake, provide over 80% of our surface water resources, and that's to meet both domestic and agricultural and other water resource needs. The thing that's valuable about snow is how consistent it is. It accumulates as a natural reservoir all winter and then gradually melts from spring into summer.
At last week's Great Salt Lake Summit, the University of Utah's Dr. Mackenzie Skiles ended her presentation by talking about a warning sign from another mountain range, the San Juan Mountains in neighboring Colorado.
The dust deposition in the San Juans in southwestern Colorado is so extreme that snowmelt in some years is advanced by 2 months. And so this is a case study in caution. We don't want our dust deposition to get to these levels, to be accelerated like it is in southern Colorado. So at this point, we have something, we can do something about it and hopefully address this dust source that's directly adjacent to our mountains and our natural water reservoir.
Speaking of lessons to be learned from elsewhere, Dr. Perry, the atmospheric scientist you heard from earlier, well, like others at the conference, he pointed to the Owens Lake in California, a lake that was dried up when its water was diverted for growth in Los Angeles, as a warning sign for the state of Utah.
The consequences of that lake loss are pretty severe. It violates the National Ambient Air Quality Standards, which means that the air is unhealthy to breathe. It was in 2010 was generating more than 300,000 tons of dust, and that dust contained arsenic, which is a carcinogen, and also contained significant quantities of cadmium. And it affected the health of the people that lived in the area, and the people were moving out of the area, which depressed the economy. And what's interesting is that the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power has spent more than $2 billion, that's billion with a B, in order to try and mitigate the dust from the lake bed without putting water back in. So they tried everything that you can imagine. They basically grow shrubs, they built fences, they used sprinklers, they applied binders to the dust, everything in trying to limit the dust from this lake bed. And what they found is after $2 billion that the best solution was to have water on top of the lake. So they spent $2 billion and they have made some progress. 20 years ago, they had 29 exceedances per year of air quality. They have now reduced that to 13. So it's still a work in progress. They've spent $2 billion and they're still going to have to spend more to continue to try and improve the air quality.
So what is being done about this crisis? Well, the siren bells are being sounded. House Speaker Brad Wilson says he's awakened to the crisis, due partly, I should say, because he listened to some colleagues in public radio.
About 6 months ago, I was actually going for a run, and a colleague had sent me a podcast from Radio West on the state and fate of the Great Salt Lake. And as I was listening to this podcast, which was really kind of this interesting in-depth look at the lake and what it would mean for Utah if the lake continued to decline, I was terrified. And as soon as I finished listening to that, I texted my chief of staff and I said, we need to talk about the Great Salt Lake differently and more aggressively. This is serious and we have to do something.
Credit where credit is due there. I mentioned earlier the legislative agenda. Well, Brigham City Republican Representative Joel Ferry, who also spoke at the conference, is this year going to run some legislation aimed at keeping water going to the lake. The idea, in its simplest form, is to pay farmers upstream for some of the water that they have rights to, or maybe even all of that water in drought years, when, Ferry says, it wouldn't be all that beneficial to the farmers anyway.
So in-stream flows, let's say a year like this, I'm going to get a 25% allocation of my water. That's not really enough for me to even grow a crop. I can place my water right, if I so choose, so that I'm not just destitute and receive no economic value, place it into an in-stream flow, which is a non-consumptive use. That water will flow downstream. I receive compensation from a conservation group, from the state of Utah, from the federal government, whoever is participating in that program. As a producer, I can receive fair market compensation, and my water will continue to benefit these needs. This is going to be one of the greatest tools that we have available to benefit the Great Salt Lake.
So in-stream flows legislation could help keep water going to the lake, though there are some questions about how willing farmers will be to lease their water. Time will tell there. The Great Salt Lake Summit also highlighted the money coming in from the American Rescue Plan, or ARPA, Act that will be used for water conservation measures. It's also a push to better account for water, that is to say, to meter water where it isn't being metered, which will help people and farmers conserve it. There's also money available to integrate water use planning and land use planning, something that really hasn't been happening in Utah.
Well, I think we have to acknowledge it's really pretty powerful that the speaker and other members of the legislature, the leadership of the state, the governor's office, have now all come to realize the value and importance of protecting the lake and preserving its many benefits to all of us who live here.
That's Steve Erickson, Utah coordinator for the Great Basin Water Network and policy advocate for the Utah Audubon Council.
It's been a long time coming. For those of us in the water arena as advocates for the lake, for some of us for many decades, it's gratifying. It's a little late to the game, but we'll take it.
Erickson is a longtime observer of water policy in Utah, and he says that he's in favor of basically all of those proposals to preserve water for the lake. But he says there was something missing altogether from Speaker Wilson's Great Salt Lake Summit.
Yes, the Bear River Development Project is the elephant in the room, and it's still an ongoing project. They're still working on plans. They're still acquiring rights of way for the project. We've spent over $30 million on Bear River development to date. You can't have enough water in Great Salt Lake if you keep diverting water upstream from the lake or up gradient from the lake.
The Bear River Development Project is a plan the state of Utah is pursuing that would divert at least 220,000 acre-feet of water from the river every year to fuel growth along the Wasatch Front. The Bear is the lake's largest tributary, and so pulling more water out of it would be very consequential. And just while we're on the topic of diverting water, I want to quickly insert another clip here from U of U atmospheric scientist Dr. Kevin Perry.
We know that the Great Salt Lake has been declining for a variety of reasons. Many people think that it's just due to drought. The larger issue is basically identified by a study that was performed at Utah State University by Wurzbau et al. And they determined that the long-term natural elevation of the lake is actually 4,207 feet. And that 11 feet of that drop is essentially due to water diversion activities. And that 6 feet of the drop is currently due to our ongoing drought. So drought is contributing to our problems, but our water use policies are a bigger issue right now.
So upstream diversions for cities, for farming, that's the main cause of the Great Salt Lake's crisis. Climate change and drought, though, are making things worse. Plans to further divert water out of the Bear River for a new reservoir have been pushed back. The project was originally approved by the legislature 3 decades ago, but it has yet to happen. And now water managers say that it won't be needed until 2050. Still, when you think about it, that's really not all that far in the future. And the state's Division of Water Resources is ramping up efforts to acquire land that pipes can run across to fill a reservoir. Again, here's Steve Erickson.
It is something that we're going to have to make some choices down the road. I mean, to keep pushing back the need for Bear River development is good, but at what point is it going to be possible to have Bear River development for more real estate development and growth versus saving the lake? We're not at that juncture yet, but that time will come. And it's past time that we have those discussions in a real serious way with policymakers.
Another longtime advocate for the Great Salt Lake is Lynn DeFreitas. She's executive director of the Friends of Great Salt Lake. I caught up with her during a break in last week's summit, and she said that she, like Erickson, was very glad to see the conference happening. But she also wants to see the end of the Bear River development project.
There's a lot of bad news if we don't effectively respond. And so I think it's timely. It's right before the 2022 legislative session. The hope is that the outcome from that session will prove productive and beneficial to address these needs for the lake.
The state still seems to be pursuing plans to create a diversion on the Bear River. And I'm wondering if there's room for that to happen, given what's going on with the lake right now.
So my hope would be that as we regard our behavior about our limited water resource, and we improve our conservation practices, and we increase our accountability of, say, infrastructure problems where we're losing water, where we should actually be more efficient in transmission of water and utilization, that a new water development project, the Bear River Water Development Project specifically, wouldn't be needed. I realize that politically it's very popular. There's a compact, there's an expectation, and a to-do list by the Division of Water Resources. Nonetheless, I think we could, as a state, demonstrate a different way of perhaps looking at the water from the Bear River in terms of beneficial uses other than just feeding a growing population's water needs. I think that we have a lot of natural systems that could benefit from the continuing flows of the Bear, and Great Salt Lake obviously is among them, since it's 60% of the inflows that comes to that system. So if wishes were brine shrimp, I would say that we all have an aha, and we translate the Bear River Development Project into something totally different than what we're expecting it to be at this point. Clearly, it would be, I would consider, the kiss of death for the system in the projected diminishment of inflows to the lake that are already being compounded by historic diversions since statehood, and with the shrink wrap of climate change and extreme drought eras that we're experiencing. It's irresponsible. I don't know how people could sleep at night knowing that.
During the Great Salt Lake Summit, there was, again, really no mention of the planned diversion of the lake's largest tributary. There were some references by managers of water purveyors, the water districts, to the idea of delaying the project. But it wasn't clear whether they meant further delaying it from the current timeline of 2050, or if they were just talking about the delays that have already happened. And so after the conference ended, I posed this question to Utah House Speaker and power broker Brad Wilson.
Is the Bear River infrastructure project still a go? Is it still a high priority for the state and for you?
So I think that their sentiment that infrastructure projects can be delayed because of conservation is accurate. In terms of the Bear River project, it's a complicated issue. And, you know, part of the legislature's job is to both deal with the issues of today and also deal with the issues down the road, 20 or 30 years. And that's a really interesting one. I'll be honest, I don't know the answer to that. And so it's something that we're going to have to carefully consider. And we will talk to those water district leaders and get their input.
A lot is at stake here, and a lot depends on what water managers and policymakers do to protect the lake in the short term and in the long term. We'll keep a focus on water and the lake in upcoming episodes. For example, we'll take a look at the plans to mine lithium from the lake brine. A group called Compass Minerals is trying to get to viability on that front. We'll also talk about the groundwater connections between the lake and underground aquifers, and how a plan to mine water in Iron County for growth in Cedar City could impact the lake and other areas of our little slice of the Great Basin. And, of course, we'll be following what happens at the upcoming legislative session. For now, though, we'll leave you with the Dawn Chorus at the Bear River Migratory Bird Refuge from the Western Soundscape Archive. I'm Roger McDonough. You've been listening to In the Hive here on KCPW. Thanks for tuning in, and join us again next week.